On a Monday, we meet the secretary designee of the Department of Financial Institutions, or DFI, on the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. So recall that former secretary Kathy Blumenfeld was appointed by Governor Evers to run the Department of Administration at the beginning of the year. And at that time, the then deputy secretary, Cheryl Olson Collins, was named to DFI's top post. Native of Portage, more than two decades in the private banking sector before joining DFI in 2007. What do you want to ask her about regulating and overseeing state-chartered financial institutions, like in the area of mortgage banking, credit unions, or securities and corporations? It's 800-642-1234. Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins, welcome to the Ideas Network.
I appreciate the invite. Thanks, Kate.
Well, acquaint us first. Tell us what you think you bring to leading DFI.
Well, as you have stated, I've been with the state since 2007, so in different capacities within the department. So I know all of the different divisions, and I understand how state government works. And then I also bring the private sector experience in, which I think is invaluable, to tell you the truth. So I have two different perspectives, and I think it makes for a good synergy into leadership.
Why is working in the private sector so important to being effective in DFI?
Well, I'm not saying it has to be the only reason or, you know, the most important reason, but what I think it brings is you have a different appreciation for the day-to-day work that institutions or people do in the private sector. For an example, it really makes a difference when we're regulating, say, banks and credit unions. I can understand what the bankers and are going through. They look at a lot of different aspects. When we're regulating, we look at specific policies, procedures that have been determined will equal safety and soundness of the institution. I think those can merge very nicely with the fact that we take a collaborative approach, and that is, I think, very important. It's important to our banks and credit unions, and it also is important to customers because we don't do a gotcha mentality. We try to help the institutions do exactly what they need to do for the safety and soundness of their customers. And so I think we have a mutual respect and I think a mutual understanding. And that I think if you ask any of our institutions, credit unions or banks, they'll reiterate that sentiment.
You've walked in both shoes, so to speak.
Right.
Can you lay out your top priorities for DFI and how we, as Wisconsinites, would know DFI is working for us?
I think, you know, it's kind of funny, but I think DFI is that kind of quiet agency in the background that has a lot of power in day-to-day lives that people don't even really realize. So what we do, I think a theme that runs through both themes that run through our agency is protection and education. And you'll find that everywhere. So when we're regulating, when we're examining, whether that be securities broker dealers, banks or credit unions, we're trying to protect the public. Education as well, when we talk about financial inclusion and capability, certainly education comes in there. But also, I know it's probably interesting to some of your listeners about the Ukraine and the conflict and what that has brought out, whether it be some charity scams or cyber risk, that type of thing. So we try to educate. We work behind the scenes oftentimes that people don't even realize. And then, of course, we're probably a little bit more open out there on financial literacy and inclusion. And I know this is the month for that, so we have a lot of stuff on that.
Going to get into that. But I just want to stop you right there. Has there been an uptick in charitable business formation that you've seen in the pandemic times and in these times of war in Ukraine?
That's a good question. Yes, I mean, there is an uptick. And I think what consumers have to realize, you know, it's really interesting. Wisconsinites are so generous. And, you know, it really tugs at your heartstrings to see the news and watch the horrific events that are unfolding there. but you do have to be careful, right? And so there have been more. You need to do your research before sending any money to charities claiming to help those affected by the Russian invasion on Ukraine. Mm. They, you know, the scammers see tragedies as a way to line their pockets. Now, we have a place on our website that you can look up whether or not the charity is registered. You don't want to just send money or cash. You want to do a little bit of research before you send your hard-earned dollars. And we advocate for, you know, if you want to send money and help people, we think it's wonderful. We just want you to be smart so that the money goes to the intended place. But yes, there has been an increase, and there's been more scams. People mm-hmm. will call and high-pressure pitches and want you to wire money. And so you do have to be careful in that way.
If you're just joining us, we're talking with the Department of Financial Institutions Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins, looking at more of the inner workings of the agency and what you want to know. What questions do you have for the head of DFI? Are you concerned that you won't be ready to begin repayments of student loans later this year? What could Wisconsin do to improve financial literacy? 800-642-1234. So I'm thinking about soaring home prices and your agency regulating loan originators and mortgage makers and brokers. And in the 2008 housing crisis, big banks were fined by the Justice Department for subprime lending, in which black borrowers were more likely than white borrowers to receive these risky loans. How do you make sure Wisconsin homebuyers are protected in these times and not taken advantage of by banks in lending for homes?
Well, first of all, I will say this. In Wisconsin, we have excellent financial institutions, whether they be the banks or the credit unions. They were not involved in the scams that occurred with the large institutions on the coast. We have that Midwest ethic, and our individual banks and credit unions are incredibly ethical, and they did a very good job during that crisis. Now, you know, mortgage brokers and mortgage dealers, you have to be careful. And again, I say do research. Know who you're doing your business with. We do regulate them. We do not have enough people to regulate all of the entities that are out there. And so it's important. We do hit all of our banks and credit unions. There's 150 banks and 111 credit unions right now. And we do go in and we regulate and we examine those institutions. So that was more of a bigger federal fail than in Wisconsin. I think there are discrepancies. And I think that banks learned a lot from that and credit unions as well. So I think it's not as much of an issue as far as safety and soundness. But, you know, they do talk about a housing bubble coming. You know, mm-hmm. prices, as everybody knows, are going up and up and up. Mm-hmm. And certainly that could be an issue. However, the inventory of houses is still low. There's a huge demand. It's not just a shell game of buy and sell to make money. There's actual demand out there for housing.
I just want to clarify here. Is your agency short of workforce? Do you need more people if you are not able to fully regulate or oversee the banks?
Not the banks, the credit unions.
The credit unions.
We certainly, yeah. We have both, we have a mandate, and we make that mandate every year. The examinations of banks and credit unions take place every 12 to 18 months. We have not missed a statutory deadline on that.
Okay.
What I'm saying, though, is on some of the mortgage brokers, mortgage dealers, and some of the licensed financial services, there are thousands. And so we do have a staff. At some point, I would love to be accredited in the mortgage area. We are not in Wisconsin at this time. We don't have the capability at this time to do that with people. It's not to say that we do not examine those entities, because we do. It's just that it is probably, I have to be honest, probably more on a complaint basis oftentimes, because we don't have quite as many examiners as we would like.
DFI, Department of Financial Institutions, Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins stays with us. What do you want her to prioritize in regulating state chartered banks, regulating credit unions? How do you want banks and credit unions to operate amid soaring inflation, difficult economic times? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. You're with us for the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The Department of Financial Institutions, DFI, it regulates banks and credit unions, registers, and regulates charitable organizations, and administers the Wisconsin Consumer Act, regulating consumer credit transactions and debt collection. Are you in business, banking, or lending? Perhaps you're fundraising for your 501c3 charitable organization. What questions do you have about financial regulations here in Wisconsin? Join in 800-642-1234. DFI Secretary Designee Cheryl Olson Collins is with us for about 9 more minutes. So April being Financial Literacy Month here in Wisconsin, you're working to raise awareness about financial literacy, education, financial capability. Tell us what you're working on in this area.
Sure. Well, Governor Evers is always emphasizing connecting the dots to his cabinet. And the cabinet works collaboratively to try to help Wisconsinites from multiple fronts. For example, I've been working with DADCAP on student debt and consumer protection. I have also worked with OCI, or the Commissioner for Insurance, on flood insurance and how financial institutions can assist those consumers. There's many examples. Finance touches all aspects of our lives, be it personal or professional. And so we're all connected, interconnected, and working together, we're stronger and can offer more solutions. So there, all of the events right now, this is Governor Evers has proclaimed the month of April as Financial Literacy and Capability Month in Wisconsin. That's part of a nationwide effort to raise awareness about the importance of financial literacy, education, and financial wellness. I think it's shocking that 60% of Wisconsin residents can't correctly answer basic financial literacy questions. So this is this campaign is joined by Wisconsin banks and credit unions, the insurance and financial industries, state and federal agencies, consumer groups, and private sector. And it's everybody's goal to help Wisconsinites improve their personal and household financial stability. So we have lots of events this month. The first is Money Smart Week, which is right now, Saturday.
Money Smart Week underway, yes.
Yep, until April 16th. And it's free virtual campaigns, and in fact, 1 o'clock today, there's a Spend Smart, Eat Smart webinar presented by Iowa State University Extension and Outreach. And again, that's talking a little bit about inflation. How can you make your grocery dollars, that type of thing, go farther? And today at 4 is Wisconsin 529 College Savings Program with the Milwaukee Public Library is conducting a webinar. It's at 4 to 5 today, and that's going to highlight the benefits of saving for higher education with a 529 savings plan and how to find and apply for grants and scholarships when the time comes. Tomorrow, Credit Build and Improvement. It's how Consumer Financial Protection Bureau will help you get your credit back in line. Wednesday, buying or refinancing a home, option and tools.
So lots of education going on here. Yeah. And really, you can find a webinar that perhaps is exactly what you're looking for to help you out. I just want to go to a call now. John is with us from Eau Claire. John, hi, what's on your mind?
Good morning. My question for the secretary is, how does the department notify or keep the citizenry apprised of the relative strength of the institutions that she regulates? As an example, in 2009, the largest credit union in the Chippewa Valley was privately known to be near failure, and yet her department did nothing to apprise the public of this danger. And I think the public should know these things.
John, thank you. Secretary.
Yes, well, we actually, there is a mechanism for doing that. First of all, we will report out on a quarterly basis the status of all banks and credit unions and their financial condition, not by name, but in generalities. If an institution is on the brink of failure, In banking, you will see the FDIC does a report. The ratings of individual banks are not out there. But if a bank is in such dire shape, then that will be listed. However, what you've got to remember is both our credit unions and our banks are insured. Consumers are not going to lose money either by the FDIC or the NCUA. Their money is protected in those institutions.
So that those federal protections are there to help state residents here. But you said you also feel that there is adequate disclosure if a bank or credit union is on shaky ground.
Well, if it's okay, so let me explain this as well.
Sure.
So we as examiners go into banks and credit unions. We also have our federal counterparts with us at times. So they keep a hand on it as well because they're the insurers, correct?
Mm-hmm.
So we have lots of eyes on our financial institutions in this state. And we work to improve, and we'll give an institution many items that they need to improve on if there's problems. And we watch it very, very closely. They have check-ins. We have more frequent visits into the institutions. And so it is watched very, very closely. And like I said, we don't want, let's say a bank is having trouble in a certain area. Well, you don't necessarily want to advertise that because people, the bank is not going to fail, the credit union's not going to fail, but yet people would get nervous about that. And you have the runs.
You have a run on the bank.
The banks, mm-hmm, and credit unions, like in the 20s. So we do watch it very carefully. We take Wisconsinites' protection very, very seriously. And in fact, our federal counterparts look at this very closely as well. And so we have a lot of eyes on the ball so that people do not lose money. And in fact, in Wisconsin, no consumer has lost any money on a failed bank or credit union.
Let me reintroduce you here, Cheryl Olson-Collins, Secretary Designee for the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. So companies file their annual reports with you through the Wisconsin One-Stop Business Portal. Which businesses file annual reports with your agency, and what do you do with that information?
Well, we are actually in our Division of Corporate and Consumer Services. We are ministerial in the sense that we take that information. We do not, unless they don't file, we do not have enforcement capabilities. So what we do with the information, it's on our website. You can search it. You can see what is out there for the individual corporations. We have partnerships, corporations, LLCs. The information is out there on who to contact if they are viable to do businesses or to do business. And for an example, credit unions or banks will often call to make sure that before they do a loan, to make sure that the business is registered with us.
Ah, I see. And so what if a business doesn't file their annual report or file it on time?
Well, they get plenty of notices, and if they don't, it's all defined in statute. What we will do is we will administratively dissolve the the business. Now, that doesn't mean they can't come back, pay their back fines registrations, and then get up to date. But they will not be considered a viable entity. And so where that would become a problem is if I wanted to get a loan, I'm not going to be able to get it unless I'm registered. Because the banks and credit unions are very, very diligent about looking at that. They have risk on the line, so of course they would be.
I want to land here. We only have a few seconds left. But can you tell us about the Wisconsin Consumer Act that you carry out and what that is?
Well, the Wisconsin Consumer Act is it's a protection for consumers in the state of Wisconsin. It defines everything from how you do a credit, how you do forms, are you doing the proper disclosures for people. The only problem with that act is the threshold is gotten lower and lower because, as we all know, things have gotten more and more expensive. But we do watch and try to protect consumers in that way by looking at the forms, looking at the disclosures. Are you following all the items per the statute? And that is out there in Wisconsin state statutes as well.
Secretary Olson Collins, thank you for joining us.
Well, I appreciate it. Thank you, Kate.
Cheryl Olson Collins is Secretary Designee of the Wisconsin Department of Financial Institutions. Ahead this hour, the State Capitol Report continues with Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of Green Bay is here. His district hugs the Bay of Green Bay. What do you want to discuss about relocating coal piles, about addressing PFAS contamination in Peshtigo and Marinette, or workforce issues? What are your takeaways from the legislative session? 800-642-1234 to join in. News update is next here on the Ideas Network. On a Monday, it is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You have a line to State Senator Eric Wimberger of Green Bay, whose district runs up the Bay of Green Bay from the port up through Oconto, up through Peshtigo, topping out at Marinette. The DNR has listening session number 17 set for next week concerning PFAS in Marinette, Peshtigo, and surrounding communities. What do you want to say to lawmakers and state government regulators regarding forever chemicals? Is your family affected by PFAS pollution? What do you wonder about next steps in moving coal piles from downtown Green Bay? Where should lawmakers put additional resources when state coffers are flush? 800-642-1234. State Senator Eric Wimberger is a Republican representing the 13th District. State Senator, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me. The 30th.
The 30th. Thank you. Thank you for that clarity there. So when you joined us a year ago, you said you wanted to prioritize local issues like seeing to the removal of the coal piles from along the Fox River in Green Bay. Where are you at with this goal?
Well, it got some traction, but so there's a bill by myself and David Steffen, Representative Steffen, to do that task using the federal money. There's some decisions, I guess, within the Senate primarily about not kind of going after that after the governor vetoed the one bill asking the legislature to get involved. So we didn't pursue that, I don't think, in the Senate too much, as well as much of the other ARPA bills. But we had the bill out there, and I think the governor heard what the priority was around here, and he ended up using the ARPA money, some of the ARPA money for that, about $15 million.
About $15 million state grant to move the piles. Money comes from the Neighborhood Investment Fund program. This is, as you mentioned, through federal COVID relief dollars. What will this grant enable it to do with these coal piles?
Sure. I think it's a little bit of a misnomer that it moves coal piles. It really doesn't move the piles. It's just kind of when the next ship comes in, they dump it somewhere else, and they draw down on the coal piles in the downtown area. So, like many cities with ports, there's a depository for coal. One of these is located kind of further inland into town, and it causes a lot of blight. The houses directly across the river don't have a good value simply because there's coal dust blowing on them all the time, and it really coats the houses. And then right behind that industrial area, no one wants to redevelop and invest in because it's too close to that industry. So it's come time where it's been a bit of a hurt to redevelopment and improving communities. Mm-hmm. So moving the coal piles, or relocating the coal pile deposit, is going to put it into a more industrial zone where there was already a public service power plant previously. So there was a coal pile over there, and now that WPS has moved along and gotten rid of the property, I believe the county owns it at the moment, that we can redevelop that port, which will be a significant port improvement,
Well, and
ships to come in.
I'd imagine you're trying to strike that balance, right, between economic development, a working Fox River, so to speak, but also one that is safe and healthy for residents and visually pleasing for visitors. How do you strike that balance? How do you balance out those competing interests?
Right. It's not like you can just suddenly tell people that they can't conduct business anymore, except under very extreme circumstances. So it's more of finding a deal with the people who do the coal. This opportunity opened up with the location where the WPS had their plant already. Mm-hmm. And to probably not cause any significant, you know, addition to an environmental problem, because it was already a place where there was coal piles, but then start the ball rolling to clean up a different spot that would be more aesthetic and also allow for an expansion of a tax base and a better quality of life.
What about the role of the paper industry here? They're burning this coal to fuel their paper making. Should they have a role in paying for moving these unsightly coal piles?
I don't think, actually, you know what, I think most of the coal goes down to the Fox Valley area at the moment, and not so much in the Green Bay area. But these things are things that we permitted, and that's still permitted by the DNR. So it's hard to, this is just a lifestyle choice. This isn't much more than that as to how we want to run the city and in the area and how we think society is going to go moving forward. I think naturally the coal is going to phase out. Most of the power plants use natural gas nowadays to heat their boilers. There's only a few more places left. But, you know, for the next 10, 15 years or so, the things will dwindle down, and it just should be in a different spot.
Okay, so one more question here before we move on to PFAS. Total cost of the project has been estimated at $25 million. One Green Bay Economic Development Plan from the early 2000s put the total cost at $35 to $50 million to move these piles. Where will the remaining millions come from to get this project done?
I think in the next budget cycle here coming up, there'll be a good push for it. The $15 million, yeah, we're going to need another $10 million. So it's going to phase in some things. And that was kind of the original idea, was that we'd phase in some things. So you have to build the sort of the seawall, the pilings for a ship to actually dock, the drainage, the railroad spur. And you can kind of phase in some of these segments into making it what it is over the course of time, you know, 1 or 2 years or 3 years. So I'm confident that we can get additional funding in the budget this upcoming cycle.
We heard from Tim in Green Bay, called in, couldn't stay. And if they're going to relocate the coal piles to the Green Bay Yacht Club, Tim says, another full-service marina, Tim saying they think maybe they need to think twice about where they want to move the coal piles. Marinas trying to attract boaters and yachters, that seems right there, Tim says, a competing interest.
That there were coal piles there before, and actually the coal piles would be on the opposite side of the river. They wouldn't be at the marina. And I think there are some remedial efforts that can be made with netting or covering that can prevent a lot of the coal dust that isn't being directly kind of put on houses and breathed in by the residents.
Talking with Eric Wimberger, State Senator of the 30th District in Green Bay, you can join in. What questions do you have for the State Senator? What bills do you want the legislature to act on? Should lawmakers have stayed in session longer? And have lawmakers done enough to address PFAS contamination in water? 800-642-1234. Attorney General Josh Call suing Johnson Controls and Tyco Fire Products for discharging PFAS into your district, the Marinette area. Mm-hmm. Your district covers Marinette. Do you support Wisconsin's lawsuit?
It's not that I suppose the short answer is yes, if it can be supported. It's if there's some harm that was done and it can be supported in a lawsuit. I'm just highly suspicious of.
Wait, you're suspicious that harm was done?
No, that the lawsuit is viable. And the reason I say that is Attorney General Call is basing the lawsuit on the Hazardous Substances Act, which requires what to be proven is a significant contribution to mortality, a serious irreversible harm, and a substantial hazard. And now, whether we think of PFAS personally having those qualities, what we had in November, I mean, we're talking 4 or 5 months ago now, but in November of 2021, the DNR and Governor Evers' administration spread PFAS-laden biosolids in Little River at the tune of 100 to 150,000 parts per trillion. It's 150,000 parts. And meanwhile, there's a surface water standard that they were advocating for that was 20 parts per trillion. So when he's going to go to court and say that the things that are happening are causing a significant harm or a serious hazard or whatever, I think the actions of the state are going to be counterproductive to being able to support that claim.
Well, Tyco said in a statement about this lawsuit that it's responding to the suit. It's building a groundwater extraction and treatment system that will treat 95% of the PFAS in area groundwater, set to be complete by summer. And it's removing contaminated soil. And I'm wondering, whose job is it to monitor and evaluate their remediation work and ensure that they deliver and follow through on these cleanup plans?
Yeah, without an actual rule on PFAS, there's just a General Hazardous Substances Act, and it could be any substance. So I think Johnson Controls is trying to be ahead of that, and also ahead of the claims of a common law nuisance, which are the basis of their previous lawsuits. So I think what they're trying to do is do the remediation efforts before they're even ordered to do remediation efforts. And I think if the lawsuit continues on, what they're going to do is they're going to subject Johnson Controls to remediation efforts, and I think they're just trying to stay ahead of that game there.
Talking from Rich from Green Bay with an email here. Rich wants to know, what exactly have you and fellow Republicans in the state Senate, in the legislature as a whole, Rich says, done to clean up PFAS in the area?
I think that's a pretty complicated question. I think the first thing we need to do is stop putting it on the soil, because there's going to be a bifurcated problem here. The first is Johnson Controls, and they're going to be held to whatever the DNR and the executive branch authorizes. Currently, there's the rulemaking authority, and there's a whole branch of law called administrative law as to why we do the process through that system. Once a standard is set, then people, farmers who are outside of that standard are going to be subject to the Hazardous Waste or Hazardous Substances Act and whatever PFAS regulation, and subject to remediation orders, and they can be fined up to $1,000 a day for non-compliance. So once the standard is actually put through, there has to be a genuine plan as to how to figure out helping these people who are not Johnson Controls, but took PFAS-laden biosolids and are out of the standard from going bankrupt, because in essence, you'll be declaring all of their farm fields brownfields. So I think it's larger than just trying to dig up soil in a circumstance, because I don't think that's necessarily going to be possible. You're talking poisoned wells 50, 100 feet down, and all that soil in between, that's just a task that's going to be difficult to figure out and pare down once the standard is set.
We have Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger on the State Capitol Report as we break down issues in his district of Green Bay, other matters circulating at the Capitol. Do you live or work in the Green Bay area? What is on your mind to tell lawmakers? How do you feel about the Gableman investigation? 800-642-1234. Back in a moment for more State Cap here on the Ideas Network. It It is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We're in conversation with Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of Green Bay, whose district spans from Marinette to Green Bay along the edge of the bay, if you can visualize that. What bills do you want lawmakers to prioritize next year? How do you feel about the findings to date in the GOP-backed Gableman investigation of the 2020 election? What water quality or workforce issues do you want the state Senate to understand? Still time for you, 800-642-1234. State Senator Eric Wimberger stays with us for about 9 more minutes. Let's move to the Gableman investigation. You're a lawyer, as well as a state lawmaker, of course. We're talking with you. How do you feel about the lawsuit by former Justice Gableman against Green Bay Mayor Eric Genrich in particular and Madison's mayor regarding the 2020 election, that they would force them to sit for depositions or be jailed if they don't cooperate?
I have a deviation from my interpretation of the subpoena statute, and I think there's some problems from the beginning, but I think the intention's good, that there were genuine problems with what we call Zuckerbucks, I guess, but any money, private money, going to specific cities, causing a disproportionate impact on turnout. So what we're kind of entering is a paradigm where one city or another is going to be given direct money from private institutions for turnout, and that's going to cause an advantage. I mean, it's kind of obvious. So if you have a city that has a 60 or 70% turnout in the party that you're opposed to, and all this money goes into turnout with at the discretion of the mayor to be used, well, then you're going to have some tight races that go one way or the other, more or less, because of those efforts.
Well, I want to pop in here for just a moment, because quoting from a new article in the New Republic, it said roughly 70% of the grants that you're talking about were awarded to election departments that serve fewer than 25,000 registered voters, and that there were no partisan questions in the application. But even with that aside, the Election Infrastructure Initiative says as much as $53 billion will be needed in the next decade to ensure elections can be conducted securely and fairly. Where do you suggest our towns, our villages, our cities get this money?
Sure. Well, the number of grants, there were a lot of little towns that got the grants, but the total dollar amount was something like 80 or 85% went to those five cities. And that's kind of beyond the question, because the idea of it being lawful simply means that the door is open now to rush a bunch of money in and play that game. So whether you think in the 2020 election the effects were there, the system-wide long-term procedural effect is that the thing is permitted, and it's going to go down a rabbit hole. So when you have cities that the mayor, even if it's a nonpartisan position, like for instance in Green Bay, it's a nonpartisan position, but the mayor was a assemblyman in the Democrat caucus. Well, then you get a bunch of money from a private institution, and the mayor and the city council decide where the bus routes go to collect up people that want to go to the polls, and you put those through particular neighborhoods you want or don't want. And it just can go down a Pandora's box. So it has to stop altogether. Now the legislature did have a bill out that said, well, any private money has to be given to the state and then distributed pro rata among all of the cities in some sort of fair way. And Governor Evers vetoed that. So I think that would be the only way to maybe possibly handle it if you're going to accept the private money. But I don't think that counties and cities are really lacking in resources. In particular, the reason I say that is Green Bay had rejected the help from the National Guard and instead opted for the private funds.
I want to circle back to the Gableman investigation. When do you think the investigation should be over?
Don't know, because I'm not privy to that. That's not my house. But I am encouraged that it uncovered some issues within the system. Whether you think there actually was a fraud or don't, the idea of the old saying in law school is that the impression of an injustice being done is as detrimental to society as an actual injustice. And the reason is because people behave a particular way or react a particular way based on what they think is going on. So if you think there's an injustice, you know, the ramifications throughout society are going to be as if it had actually happened. So to flush that out and kind of nail down some of the procedural problems or failings in the system, even if they weren't taken advantage of this time, we can shore that up. And I think that's also kind of my disappointment with Governor Evers and his vetoes in the last couple of years, is that a lot of these things exposed potential problems at least, and they were kind of categorized as, well, that's just the Republicans doing this and that, when they were genuine. There were a lot of genuine real issues that needed to be addressed.
So if Assembly Speaker Robin Voss, who has given the Gableman investigation $676,000 to conduct it, if Gableman requests additional funds, should Voss allocate more dollars to this investigation?
Yeah, like I said, I don't know the details of his thing. One of the things that is discouraging to me is that there was a hearing in front of the Assembly where there were these videos of people in nursing homes, and really only three questions to be had. Who voted? Did they have, were their rights taken by Chapter 51? Were they incompetent? And if the answer is, did they vote and they're competent, well, did someone tell them to vote? And those pretty much are the only three questions to be had. And there's only 150 or 200 registered voters in these nursing homes, it looks like. So you could basically ask every single one of them in the amount of time that was used to make these videos. And that was so far off the mark to me, to actually come to a better understanding of the truth. But I don't know the exact details of what's needed. So, and it's not my branch, so I can't even really get a straight answer by talking to my majority leader.
So it sounds, you can't get a straight answer, you said, when you talk to your majority leader, just a
well,
couple
if it seconds. Was in our, if it was in our branch, yeah, I could just say, hey, you know, Devin, you know, let me, you know, what's going on with this, but it's not my branch, so I don't really have communication there.
Thank you for joining us.
Oh, can I just say that on the PFAS issue, I do want to advance some grants for solar plants on farm fields that are PFAS laden and are going to be polluted. And also, I think a lot of this stems from a landfill. We need a landfill that can take PFAS biosolids.
Okay.
And that would help a lot with the municipalities. And
we'll explore.
Those are some things I want to effort.
We'll definitely explore that in the future with Republican State Senator Eric Wimberger of the 30th District in Green Bay, first elected to the State Senate in 2020. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. This is the State Capitol Report on The Morning Show, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.